Hello. Welcome back to another section of Gentlemen in Moscow by Amar Towles. Hope you're enjoying this one. I really am. I love the way it's written. We stopped last time in the middle of a chapter titled Advent. We're now on page 90. At the bottom, there's a little star icon there. Lordy. It is a Saturday morning where I am, so I am hoping and praying that we're gonna experience less traffic noise from like deliveries that would happen during the week. So fingers crossed. If you're liking this one, make sure you hit the like and subscribe so that you catch the rest of the book. And let's get started here. Page 90 at the bottom with the star. December in the Piazza. From the day the Metropole opened its doors, the good people of Moscow had looked to the Piazza to set the tone of the season, for by 5 o'clock on the 1st of December, the room had already been festooned in the anticipation of the new year. Evergreen garlands with bright red berries hung from the fountain, strings of lights fell from the balconies, and revelers from all across Moscow they came, such that by 8 o'clock, when the orchestra struck up its first festive song, every table was spoken for. By 9, the waiters were dragging chairs in from the corridors so that latecomers could hang their arms over the shoulders of friends, and at the center of every table, whether it was hosted by the high or the humble, was a serving of caviar. For it is the genius of this particular delicacy that it may be enjoyed by the ounce or the pound. As such, it was with a touch of disappointment that the Count entered the piazza on this winter solstice to find the room ungarlanded, the balustrades unstrung, an accordion player on the bandstand, and 2/3 of the tables empty. But then, as every child knows, the drumbeat of the season must sound from within. And there, at her usual table by the fountain, was Nina, with a dark green ribbon tied around the waist of her bright yellow dress. "Merry Christmas," said the Count with a bow when he reached the table. Nina stood and curtsied. "The joys of the season to you, sir." When they were seated with their napkins in their laps, Nina explained that as she would be meeting her father for dinner a little later, she had taken the liberty of ordering herself an hors d'oeuvre. "Quite sensible," said the Count. At that moment, the bishop appeared, carrying a small tower of ice creams. "The hors d'oeuvre?" "Oui," Nina replied. Having placed the dish before Nina with a priestly smile, the bishop turned and asked the Count if the Count would like a menu, as if he didn't know it by heart. "No, thank you, my good man, just a glass of champagne and a spoon." Systematic in all matters of importance, Nina ate her ice cream one flavor at a time, moving from the lightest to the darkest in shade. Thus, having already dispatched her French vanilla, she was now moving on to a scoop of lemon, which perfectly matched her dress. "So," said the Count, "are you looking forward to your visit home?"
"Yes, it will be very nice to see everyone," said Nina. "But when we return to Moscow in January, I shall be starting school."
"You don't seem very excited by the prospect."
"I fear it will be dreadfully dull," she admitted, "and positively overrun with children."
The Count nodded gravely to acknowledge the indisputable likelihood of children in the schoolhouse. Then, as he dipped his own spoon into the scoop of strawberry, he noted that he had enjoyed school very much.
"Everybody tells me that.
I loved reading the Odyssey and the Aeneid, and I made some of the finest friends of my life."
"Yes, yes," she said with a roll of her eyes. "Everybody tells me that too."
"Well, sometimes everybody tells you something because it's true."
"Sometimes," Nina clarified. "Everybody tells you something because they are everybody. But why should one listen to everybody? Did everybody write the Odyssey? Did everybody write the Aeneid?" She shook her head, then concluded definitively, "The only difference between everybody and nobody is all the shoes."
Perhaps the Count should have left it at that, but he hated the idea of his young friend beginning her Moscow school days with such a desolatory view.
As she progressed through the dark purple scoop, presumably blackberry, he considered how best to articulate the virtues of a formal education. While there are certainly some irksome aspects to school, he conceded after a moment, I think you will find to your eventual delight that the experience has broadened your horizons. Nina looked up. What do you mean by that?
What do I mean by what?
By broadened your horizons.
The Count's assertion had seemed so axiomatic that he had not prepared an elaboration, so before responding, he signaled the bishop for another glass of champagne. For centuries, champagne had been used to launch marriages and ships. Most assume this is because the drink is so intrinsically celebratory, but in fact, it is used at the onset of these dangerous enterprises because it so capably boosts one's resolve. When the glass was placed on the table, the Count took a swig large enough to tickle his sinuses. By broadening your horizons, he ventured, what I meant is that education will give you a sense of the world's scope, of its wonders, of its many and varied ways of life. Wouldn't travel achieve that more effectively?
Travel?
We are talking about horizons, aren't we? That horizontal line at the limit of sight? Rather than sitting in orderly rows in a schoolhouse, wouldn't one be better served by working her way toward an actual horizon so that she could see what lay beyond it? That's what Marco Polo did when he traveled to China, and what Columbus did when he traveled to America, and what Peter the Great did when he traveled through Europe incognito. Nina paused to take a great mouthful of the chocolate, and when the Count appeared to reply, she waved her spoon to indicate that she was not yet finished. He waited attentively for her to swallow. Last night, my father took me to Scheherazade.
Ah, the Count replied, grateful for the change of subject.
Rimsky-Korsakov at his best.
Perhaps, I wouldn't know. The point is, according to the program, the composition was intended to enchant the listeners with the world of the Arabian Nights.
That realm of Aladdin. And the lamp, said the Count with a smile.
Exactly. And in fact, everyone in this theater seemed utterly enchanted.
Well, there you are.
And yet, not one of them has any intention of going to Arabia, even though that is where the lamp is.
By some extraordinary conspiracy of fate, at that very instant Nina made this pronouncement, the accordion player concluded an old favorite, and the sparsely populated room broke into applause. Sitting back, Nina gestured to her fellow customers with both hands as if their ovation were the final proof of her position. It is the mark of a fine chess player to tip over his own king when he sees that defeat is inevitable, no matter how many moves remain in the game. Thus, the Count inquired, How was your hors d'oeuvre?
Splendid.
The accordion player now began to play a jaunty little melody reminiscent of an English carol. Taking this as his signal, the Count indicated that he would like to make a toast. It is a sad but unavoidable fact of life, he began, that as we age, our social circles grow smaller, whether from increased habit or diminished vigor. We suddenly find ourselves in the company of just a few familiar faces. So I view it as an incredible stroke of good fortune at this stage in my life, to have found such a fine new friend. With that, the Count reached into his pocket and presented Nina with a gift. Here's a little something that I made great use of when I was your age. May it tide you over until you travel incognito. Nina smiled in a manner that suggested, rather unconvincingly, that he absolutely shouldn't have. Then she unwrapped the paper, to reveal the Countess Rostov's hexagonal opera glasses. They were my grandmother's, said the Count. For the first time in their acquaintance, Nina was struck dumb. She turned the little binoculars in her hands, admiring the mother-of-pearl scopes, delicate brass fittings. Then she held them to her eye so she could slowly scan the room.
You know me better than anyone, she said after a moment. I shall treasure them to my dying day. That she had not thought to bring a present for the Count struck him as perfectly understandable. After all, she was only a child, and the days of unwrapping surprises were decidedly behind him. It's getting late, said the Count. I wouldn't want to keep you, your father, waiting. Yes, she admitted regretfully. It is time for me to go. Then, looking back toward the captain's station, she raised a hand as one who signals for the check. But when the captain approached the table, he did not have the check. Instead, he had a large yellow box tied with dark green ribbon. Here, Ida said, is a little something for you, but you must promise that you will not open it until the stroke of midnight. When Nita left the piazza to join her father, the Count's intention had been to settle the check, proceed to the Boyarsky for an urban-crusted lamb chop, and then to retire to his study with a glass of port to await the chime of 12. But as the accordion player launched into a second carol, the Count found himself turning his attention to the neighboring table, where a young man seemed to be in the earliest stages of romantic discovery. In some lecture hall, this lad, with a hint of a mustache, had presumably admired his fellow student for the sharpness of her intellect and the seriousness of her mien. Mien? M-I-E-N. Love the vocabulary. We're getting some new stuff. Eventually, he had worked up to the nerve to invite her out, perhaps under the pretense of discussing some matter of ideological interest. And now, here she was, sitting before him in the piazza, looking about the room without a smile on her face or a word on her lips. Attempting to break the silence, the lad remarked on the upcoming conference to unify the Soviet republics, a reasonable gambit given her apparent intensity. Sure enough, the young lady had views on the subject, but as she voiced her opinion on the Transcaucasus question, the tenor of the conversation turned decidedly technical. What's more, the young man, having adopted an expression as serious as hers, was clearly out of his depth. Were he to venture his own opinion now, he would almost certainly be revealed as a poser, as one who was inadequately informed on the crucial issues of the day. From there, the evening could only get worse, and he would end up dragging his hopes behind him in the manner of the chastened child who drags his stuffed bear thumping up the stairs. But just as the young lady was inviting him to share his thoughts on the matter, the accordion player began a little number with a Spanish flair. It must have struck a chord, because she interrupted herself in order to look at the musician and wonder aloud where that melody was from. It is from the Nutcracker, the young man responded without a thought. The Nutcracker, she repeated. Given the prevailing sobriety of her expression, it was unclear what she thought of this music from another era. As such, many a veteran would have counseled the young man to proceed with caution, to wait and hear what associations the music held for her. Instead, he acted, and he acted boldly. When I was a boy, my grandmother took me every year. The young lady turned back from the musician to face her companion. I suppose some think the music sentimental, he continued, but I never fail to attend the ballet when it is performed in December, even if it means attending alone. Well done, lad. The expression on the girl's face softened noticeably, and her eyes displayed a hint of interest. And here was an unexpected aspect of her new acquaintance, something pure and heartfelt and unapologetic. Her lips parted as she prepared to ask a question. Are you ready to order? It was the bishop leading over the table. Of course they are not ready to order, the Count wished to shout, as any fool can see. If the young man were wise, he would send the bishop packing and ask the young lady to go on with her question. Instead, he dutifully picked up the menu. Perhaps he imagined that the perfect dish would leap off the page and identify itself by name. But for a hopeful young man trying to impress a serious young woman, the menu of the piazza was as perilous as the streets of Messina. On the left was a skyla of lower price dishes that could suggest a penny-pinching lack of flair, and on the right was a charbis of charybdis of delicacies that could empty one's pockets while painting one pretentious. The young man's gaze drifted back and forth between these opposing hazards, but in a stroke of genius, he ordered the Latvian stew. While this traditional dish of pork, onions, and apricots was reasonably priced, it was also reasonably exotic and somehow harkened back to that world of grandmothers and holidays and sentimental melodies that they had been about to discuss when so rudely interrupted. "I'll have the same," said our serious young lady. "The same." And then she glanced at her hopeful young acquaintance with a touch of that tenderness that Natasha had shown Pierre in War and Peace at the end of Volume 2. "And would you like some wine to go with your stew?" asked the bishop. The young man hesitated and then picked up the wine list with uncertain hands. It may well have been the first time in his life that he had ordered a bottle of wine. Never mind that he didn't grasp the merits of the 1900 versus the 1901. He didn't know a Burgundy from a Bordeaux. Giving the young man no more than a minute to consider his options, the bishop leaned forward and poked the list with a condescending smile. "Perhaps the Rioja." Rioja? Now there was a wine that would clash with the stew as Achilles clashed with Hector. It would slay the dish with... I read a book another time that Hector was in the story, but maybe he was from somewhere else. Achilles clashed with Hector. It would slay the dish with a blow to the head and drag it behind its chariot until it tested the fortitude of every man in Troy. Besides, it plainly cost three times what the young man could afford. With a shake of the head, the count reflected that there was simply no substitute for experience. Here had been an ideal opportunity for a waiter to fulfill his purpose by recommending a suitable wine. He could have put a young man at ease, perfected a meal, and furthered the cause of romance, all in a stroke. But, whether from a lack of subtlety or a lack of sense, the bishop had not only failed in his purpose, he had put his customer in a corner, and the young man, clearly unsure of what to do and beginning to feel as if the whole restaurant were watching, was on the verge of accepting Bishop's suggestion. "If I may," the count interjected, "for a serving of Latvian stew, you will find no better choice than a bottle of the Mukuzani." Leaning toward their table and mimicking the perfectly parted fingers of the entry, the count gestured to the entry on the list. That this wine was a fraction of the cost of the Rioja need not be a matter of discussion between gentlemen. Instead, the count simply noted, the Georgians practically grow their grapes in the hopes that one day they will accompany such a stew. The young man exchanged a brief glance with his companion as if to say, "Who is this eccentric?" But then he turned to the bishop. "A bottle of the Mukuzani." "Of course," replied the bishop. Minutes later, the wine had been presented and poured, and the young woman was asking her companion what his grandmother was like. While for his part, the count cast off any thoughts of herb-encrusted lamb at the Boyarsky, instead he summoned Petya to take Nina's present to his room and ordered the Latvian stew and a bottle of Mukuzani for himself. And just as he'd suspected, it was the perfect dish for the season. The onions thoroughly caramelized, the pork slowly braised, the apricots briefly stewed, the three ingredients came together in a sweet and smoky medley that simultaneously suggested the comfort of a snowed-in tavern and the jangle of a gypsy tambourine. As the count took a sip of his wine, the young couple caught his eye and raised their own glasses in a toast of gratitude and kinship. Then they returned to their conversation, which had grown so intimate it could no longer be heard over the sound of the accordion. "Young love," thought the count with a smile, "there is nothing novaya about it. Will there be anything else?"
It was the bishop addressing the count. He considered for a moment, then he asked for a single scoop of vanilla ice cream. All right. Page 98 with the star on the bottom. As the count entered the lobby, he noticed four men in evening dress coming through the door with black leather cases in hand, clearly one of the string quartets that occasionally played in the private dining rooms upstairs. Three of the musicians looked as if they had been performing together since the 19th century, sharing the same white hair and weary professionalism. But the second violinist stood out from the others, as he couldn't have been more than 22 and retained a certain brightness to his step. It was only as the quartet approached the elevator that the count recognized him. The count probably hadn't seen Nikolai Petrov since 1914, when the prince had been no more than a lad of 13. And given the passage of time, the count might not have recognized him at all were it not for his unassuming smile, a distinguishing feature of the Petrov line for generations. Nikolai? When the count spoke, the four musicians turned from the elevator and eyed him with curiosity. Alexander Ilyich? The prince asked for a moment. None other. The prince encouraged his colleagues to go ahead and then offered the count the familial smile. It's good to see you, Alexander. And you. They were quiet for a moment, then the prince's expression changed from one of surprise to curiosity. Is that ice cream? What? Oh yes, it is, though not for me. The prince nodded in bemusement, but without further remark. Tell me, the count ventured, have you heard from Dmitri? I believe he is in Switzerland. Ah, said the count with a smile, the purest air in Europe. The prince shrugged, as if to say he had heard something of the sort, but wouldn't know firsthand. The last time I saw you, observed the count, you were playing Bach at one of your grandmother's dinner parties. The prince laughed and held up his case. I guess I'm still playing Bach at dinner parties. Then he gestured toward the departed elevator and said with unmistakable fondness, that was Sergei Aisanov. No! At the turn of the century, Sergei Aisanov had given music lessons to half the boys on the boulevard ring. It's not easy for our likes to find work, said the prince, but Sergei hires me when he can. The count had so many questions. Were there other members of the Petrov family still in Moscow? Was his grandmother alive? Was he still living in that wonderful house on the Pushkin Square? But the two were standing in the middle of a hotel lobby as men and women headed up the stairs, including some in formal clothes. They'll be wondering what's to come of me, said the prince. Yes, of course, I didn't mean to keep you. The prince nodded and turned to mount the stairs, but then turned back. We are playing here again on Saturday night, he said. Perhaps we could meet afterwards for a drink. That would be splendid, said the count. Now we have a great long footnote. I don't know if you can, like, see the line there, but we've got our asterisks and we've got our footnotes. So we're going to address that. It's on page 100. Among readers of European fiction, the character names in Russian novels are notorious for their difficulty. Not content to rely on given and family names, we Russians like to make use of honorifics, patronymics, and an array of diminutives, such that a single character in one of our novels may be referred to in four different ways in as many pages. To make matters worse, it seems that our greatest authors, due to some deep-rooted sense of tradition or complete lack of imagination, constrain themselves to the use of 30 given names. You cannot pick up a work of Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, or Turgenev without bumping into an Anna, an Andrei, or an Alexander. Thus, it must be with some trepidation that our Western reader meets any new character in a Russian novel, knowing that in the remote chance this character plays an important role in future chapters, he must now stop,
and commit the name to memory. As such, I think it only fair to inform you now that while Prince Nikolai Petrov has agreed to meet the Count on Saturday night for a drink, he will not be keeping the appointment. For when the quartet finishes their engagement at midnight, young Prince Nikolai will button his overcoat, tighten his scarf, and walk to his family's residence on Pushkin Square. Needless to say, when he arrives at 12:30, there are no footmen to greet him. With his violin in hand, he mounts the staircase headed toward the room on the fourth floor that has been left to his use. Though the house seems empty, on the second floor, Nikolai comes upon two of the house's newer residents smoking cigarettes. Nikolai recognizes one of them as the middle-aged woman who now lives in the nursery. The other is the bus operator with a family of four who lives in his mother's boudoir. When the prince wishes them a good night with the unassuming smile of the house, neither says a word. But when he reaches the fourth floor, he understands their reticence and can hardly blame them. For standing in the hallway are three men from the Chika waiting to search his room. Upon seeing them, Prince Nikolai does not make a scene or voice some idle protest. After all, it is the third time they have searched his room in 6 months. And he even recognizes one of the fellows. So familiar with the procedure and weary from a long day, he offers them the same unassuming smile, lets them inside, and sits at the little table by the window as they go about their business. The prince has nothing to hide. Just 16 years old when the Hermitage fell, he has never read a tract or harbored a grudge. If you asked him to play the imperial anthem, he wouldn't remember how. He even sees some sense in his grand old house being divvied up. His mother and sisters in Paris, his grandparents dead, the family servants all scattered to the winds. And what was he going to do with 30 rooms? All he really needed was a bed, a wash basin, and a chance to work. But at 2 in the morning, the prince is awakened with a shove by the officer in charge. In his hands is a textbook, a Latin grammar from Nikolai's days at the Imperial Lyceum. Is it yours? There is no point in lying. Yes, he says, I attended the academy when I was a boy. The officer opens the book, and there on the front plate, looking regal and wise, is a picture of Tsar Nicholas II, the possession of which is a crime. The prince has to laugh, for he had taken such pains to remove all portraits, crests, and royal insignia from his room. The captain slices the page out of the grammar with a blade of a knife. He marks the back with the time and place and has the prince undersign it. The prince is taken to the Lubyanka, where he is held for several days and questioned once again regarding his loyalties. On the fifth day, all things considered, fate spares him, for he is not ushered to the courtyard and put against the wall, nor is he shipped off to Siberia. He is merely given a -6, the administrative sentence that allows him to roam Russia at will as long as he never sets foot in Moscow, St. Petersburg, Kiev, Kharkov, Yekaterinburg, and Tbilisi. That is, the country's six largest cities. About 50 miles from Moscow, in Tushkovo, the young prince resumes his life, and for the most part, he does so without resentment, indignation, or nostalgia. In his new hometown, the grass still grows, the fruit trees blossom, and young women come of age. In addition, by virtue of his remoteness, he is spared the knowledge that 1 year after his sentence, a trio of Cheka will be waiting for his old instructor when he comes home to the small apartment where he lives with his aging wife. When they haul him before a troika, what seals his fate and sends him to the camps is evidence that on multiple occasions he had hired former person Nikolai Petrov to play in his quartet, despite a clear prohibition against doing so. But, having said that, you needn't bother to remember the name of Prince Petrov. I should note that despite the brief appearance of the round-faced fellow with a receding hairline a chapter hence, he is someone you should commit to memory, for years later, he will have great bearing on the outcome of this tale.
We're on page 102 at the top with the star. When the count arrived on the sixth floor, he clicked his tongue 3 times, then went into his bedroom, leaving the door ajar. On the desk sat Nina's gift, where Petya had left it. Taking it under an arm, the count passed through his jackets into his study, set the present on his grandmother's table, and put the bowl of melted ice cream on the floor. As the count poured himself a glass of port, a silvery shadow swerved around his feet and approached the bowl. "Happy holidays to you, Herr Drosselmeier." "Meow," replied the cat. According to the twice-tolling clock, it was only 11. So with his port in one hand and a Christmas carol in the other, the count tilted back his chair and dutifully waited for the chime of 12. Admittedly, it takes a certain amount of discipline to sit in a chair and read a novel, even a seasonal one, when a beautifully wrapped present waits within arm's reach and the only witness is a one-eyed cat. But this is a discipline the count had mastered as a child when, in the days leading up to Christmas, he had marched past the closed drawing room doors with the unflinching stare of a Buckingham Palace guard. The young count's self-mastery did not stem from a precocious admiration of military regimentation, nor a priggish adherence to household rules. By the time he was 10, it was perfectly clear that the count was neither priggish nor regimental, as a phalanx of educators, caretakers, and constables could attest. No, if the count mastered the discipline of marching past the closed drawing room doors, it was because the experience had taught him this was the best means of ensuring the splendor of the season. For on Christmas Eve, when his father finally gave the signal, and he and Helena were allowed to pull the doors apart, there was the 12-foot spruce lit up from trunk to tip, and garlands hanging from every shelf. There were the bowls of oranges from Seville and the brightly colored candies from Vienna. And hidden somewhere under the tree was that unexpected gift, be it a wood sword with which to defend the ramparts, or a lantern with which to explore a mummy's tomb. Such is the magic of Christmas in childhood, thought the count, a little wistfully, that a single gift can provide one with endless hours of adventure while not even requiring one to leave one's house. Drosselmeier, who had retired on the other high-backed chair to lick his paws, suddenly turned his one-eye gaze toward the closet door with his little ears upright. What he must have heard was the whirring of inner wheels, for a second later came the first of midnight's chimes. Setting his book and his port aside, the count placed Nina's gift in his lap with his fingers on the dark green bow and listened to the tolling of the clock. Only with the 12th and final chime did he pull the ribbon's ends. "What did you think, mein Herr? A dapper hat?" The cat looked up at the count and, in deference to the season, began to purr. The count replied with a nod and then carefully lifted the lid, only to discover another box, wrapped in yellow and tied with a dark green bow. Setting the empty box aside, the count nodded again to the cat, pulled the strands of the second bow, and lifted the second lid, only to discover a third box. Dutifully, the count repeated the debowing and unwitting with the next 3 boxes. Until he held one the size of a matchbox. But he untied the bow and lifted, when he untied the bow and lifted the lid of this box, inside the cozy chamber, strung on a bit of the dark green ribbon, was Nina's passkey to the hotel. When the count climbed into bed with his Dickens at 12:15, he assumed he would only read a paragraph or two before switching off the light, but instead, he found himself reading with the greatest interest. He had reached the part of the story where Scrooge is being spirited around by that jolly giant, the Ghost of Christmas Present. Over the course of his childhood, the Count had been read a Christmas carol no less than 3 times, so he certainly remembered the visit Scrooge and his guide paid to the laughter-filled party at Scrooge's nephew's house, just as he remembered the visit they paid to the humble yet heartfelt celebration at the Cratchits. But he had completely forgotten that upon leaving the Cratchits,
the second spirit had taken Scrooge out of the city of London altogether to a bleak and deserted moor, where a family of miners was celebrating the season in their ramshackle hut at the edge of the mine, and from there to a lighthouse on a rocky outpost, where the waves thundered as the two craggy keepers of the beacon joined their hands in Yuletide song, and from there, further and further, the spirit carried Scrooge into the howling darkness of the rolling sea until they alit upon the deck of a ship where every man, good or bad, had fond thoughts of home and a kinder word for his mates. Who knows? Perhaps what stirred the count were these far-flung figures sharing in the fellowship of the season despite their lives of hard labor in inhospitable climes. Perhaps it was the sight earlier in the evening of that modern young couple proceeding toward romance in the age-old fashion. Perhaps it was the chance meeting with Nikolai, who despite his heritage seemed to be finding a place for himself in the new Russia. Or perhaps it was the utterly unanticipated blessing of Nina's friendship. Whatever the cause, when the count closed his book and turned out the light, he fell asleep with a great sense of well-being. But had the ghost of Christmas yet to come suddenly appeared, they call the ghost of Christmas future the ghost of Christmas yet to come, so I was a little confused. But had the ghost of Christmas yet to come suddenly appeared and roused the count to give him a glimpse of the future, he would have seen that his sense of well-being had been premature. For less than 4 years later, after another careful accounting of the twice-tolling clock's 12 chimes, Alexander Ilyich Rostov would be climbing to the roof of the Metropole Hotel in his finest jacket and gamely approaching its parapet in order to throw himself into the street below. That is the end of book one. We shall stop there. Yay! I know there was some traffic noise. Apologies for the pauses, but I don't want you to miss the words. I find that a little pause is better than missing what was said. So, hope you enjoyed this section, and I'll see you next time. Bye.